Well, they have common storehouses where people will get their stuff. And he's like, well, and she said, well, what if someone says people will just steal things from those storehouses? Like, what are you talking about? We'll have laws against that. Like, we'll have common storehouses. It's like people will.
He's just like what?
You dummy?
Left of Philosophy. I'm Owen, and here with me today is Gil, Will, and Lillian.
Hello.
Yo.
Hi.
So before we get started, I just wanted to mention that we will be doing our first live show in Toronto on October the 12th at the Free Times Cafe. If you're in or around Toronto, we're going to be there at that time. Make sure you come out and check it out. It's going to be a hell of a lot of fun. All right. So for today's episode, we're going to be discussing the political and social thought of 17th century English radical Gerard Winstanley. But before I introduce him and talk about what makes him such an exceptional social theorist, I want to describe the period in English history in which he was writing and situate his political ideas and proposals within the general context of radicalism between roughly 1640 and 1660. Very briefly, this period is best known for the successive civil wars that tore the British Isles apart, pitting Parliament against the monarchy, various regions and religious sects against one another in a complex and bloody struggle. The conflicts saw King Charles I beheaded, the ultimate victory of parliamentarian forces, and the establishment of a Commonwealth under the protectorate of Oliver Cromwell. In 1660, Charles II returned from exile, and the monarchy was restored, albeit within strict limitations. Okay, so this period is also often called the English Revolution, since it was characterized not just by military conflict, but by fierce economic, social, and political struggles. England, for a minute there, was a republic. They botched it, but it was, for a minute there, England actually was a republic.
Many such cases.
The turmoil and disorder wrought by the wars created a rare opening for widespread agitation, contestation of long-established authority, and what I consider a completely astonishing series of group formations, some of them quite radical, not just for their own time. Among many others, these groups included the Ranters, the Clubmen, the Agitators, Covenanters and Independents, Radical Quakers, the Levelers, the Diggers.
These names rule.
Such good names, by the way.
Excellent. Yeah. So, they all sound like band names in the 80s. I mean, yeah. Fantastic, yeah.
We have definitely lost something.
Yeah. Oh, we're the Clubmen.
I know.
Yeah. This is the only way I'm a return guy.
It's really these last two that I want to focus on, since they were the most politically radical, arguably. There's much to be said about this conjuncture that I can't touch on here, but I just want to emphasize a few of the factors that help clarify the emergence of these radical English groups and contextualize Gerard Winstanley's philosophy and practice. Okay, the first is the dissolution in this period, right, between the 1640s and 1660, the dissolution of strict royal censorship and the emergence of broadly accessible pamphlets and printouts of the speeches of MPs in Parliament, which were read widely in taverns, in alehouses, and other public settings. The second is the insurgent sects of Christianity, challenging not just papal authority, but any attempts to establish new official churches in England. This was accompanied by intense anti-clericalism and opposition to what Winstanley calls the tithe takers. Thirdly, the conscription of soldiers, particularly into the parliamentarian New Model Army, which activated the masses in a deeply political struggle. And many, especially the Levelers, sought to recruit these mobilized masses to their cause. Service in the parliamentary army drastically altered their expectations for and demands from the emerging Commonwealth. This created a major schism, too, between the grandees of the army and its rank and file, who largely came from the lower rungs of the commoners. The fourth is class antagonism. While Parliament were the military victors of the civil wars, its economic victors were the gentry, landlords, traders, and merchants. In short, the nascent agrarian bourgeoisie. the more radical factions of the Levelers and the Diggers as a whole sought a reconstituted social order that did more to strike at the roots of economic oppression. And the fifth is the ongoing struggle around and the effects of 16th and 17th century enclosures, the, quote, fencing in and fencing out, as Winstanley calls it, that progressively dispossessed the poor and deprived them of the land they relied on for their subsistence. All of this made for a unique moment, not just of mass political activity, but of brilliant political thought, which is organically connected to that political praxis. Admittedly, the standout work of political theory in this period is by Thomas Hobbes, from his 1640 Elements of Law to his 1651 Leviathan. But when taken together, the pamphlets, tracts, manifestos, and experimental constitutions by Hobbes's contemporaneous radicals constitute a formidable set of competing ideas rich with potential. Chief among such ideas are those laid out by Gerard Winstanley. Winstanley was a member and leader of the group known as the Diggers, though they preferred the name True Levelers. The Diggers, which existed from 1649 to 1651, got this name from their practice of digging and planting crops on common land, often tearing down enclosures. They fundamentally opposed the institution of private property and proclaimed themselves as true levelers because they believed that the only way to truly level society is to eliminate the principal source of social hierarchy, exclusive ownership of the earth and its bounty by an elite few accompanied by dispossession and servitude for the masses. Whereas the levelers draw from and represented primarily the interests of the lower gentry, small-scale proprietors and traders, craftsmen and others of the middling sort, the diggers mobilized and represented the interests of the poor and the propertyless, the bottom half of the commoners. They printed and distributed a host of co-written pamphlets, including one that I had the crew read for today entitled A Declaration from the Poor Oppressed People of England, in which they declare the earth a, quote, common livelihood to all without respect of persons, end quote, and call for the abolition of buying and selling altogether. In the other text we're looking at, Winstanley's The Law of Freedom in a Platform, he develops the declarations and calls to action of the Digger pamphlets into a fleshed out political theory. He addresses the law of freedom directly to Oliver Cromwell, whom he congratulates for having destroyed the monarchy, but insists that the revolutionary task is nowhere near complete. This is what he writes to Cromwell in his address to him. He says, quote, "That which is yet wanting on your part to be done is this, to see the oppressor's power cast out along with his person, and to see that the free possession of the land and liberties be put into the hands of the oppressed commoners of England." It wasn't enough to kill the king. It wasn't enough to depose Charles I. There's this thing, as I'm going to talk about in a second, called kingly power, which seems to rule over the Commonwealth as persistently. Okay, so I'll start us off, I guess, by just highlighting two of the central claims in this work that was written while Hobbes was writing Leviathan. The first claim of Winstanley's that I'd love to discuss with you guys is this idea that social pathologies like war and violence, and even pathologies of character like covetousness and envy, that they have their root in the private ownership of the earth's fruits, in monetary exchange as such. So he tries to give an account of these pathologies that makes of war not something irrational, but something that is actually quite explicable by the economic structure that we live under. The thing that I find especially interesting about this is that the way he talks about the pathologies produced by private property is that it sounds like what he's saying is what Hobbes describes as the war of all against all is not at all like our natural condition. In fact, it's precisely the opposite. And he even has a very, a religiously inflected view that our original sin is private property, but we are actually, prior to that moment, in our moment of innocence or something, we live at peace. We're meant to live at peace with, sharing the world in common. And that it is what produces that condition of like the war of all against all is in fact these social structures that are oppressive. So reversing Hobbes's view. So, and then I guess, so that's the first thing, right? Is that the social pathologies have this root in economic conditions. The second one is that it's not enough to kill the king and end the monarchy at the level of political and institutional form. That was great, good work, Cromwell. nor are even the liberal reforms proposed by a lot of the levelers, who wanted to also level society, but more at a kind of juridical level to give rights to people. That's all, formal rights and all of that are important, but that's also not enough. In order for kingly power, as he calls it, for monarchical power as such, not just the power of a single king, but for kingly power as such to be eliminated and to be overcome, and for a true commonwealth to be created, the little kings that populate that society have to also be deposed. And those little kings for him are landlords, lords of manors, lawyers,
lawyers
of various kinds. Lawyers, yeah.
My man hates
does not like lawyers. So, yeah, those are the two. I think the two things I wanted to start with. I think that last point has a certain kind of resonance with like left Republican arguments, which say that it's not just the establishment of a formal Republican state that is to be sought after, but that the spirit of Republicanism should suffuse society as a whole, so that there are not these positions of arbitrary power held over us, even on a smaller scale. From a Winstanleyan perspective, the English Revolution failed then, not simply because of the restoration of the monarchy, albeit with limited power, but because it never touched the pervasive, arbitrary, kingly power of landlords, bosses, and economic elites, to use somewhat anachronistic language. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll end it there and ask you all how you responded to all this.
Nah, I thought it was great. I mean, Winstanley, you know, I'll be up front, you know, so Winstanley and all this stuff, it's far outside my wheelhouse, you know, historically speaking. So I was telling, you know, the crew before we started, you know, Owen likes those sign things that, you know, like, you live in the 17th and 16th century and, you know, the spelling is weird to me. And whenever I start, I'm just like, oh my God, not again. But then when I'm five pages in, I'm like, damn, let him cook. Okay, so I think the first thing I'd like to talk about is your question about, you know, character and social pathology. And so when Stanley keeps coming back to this problem of, you know, when you have a society premised on buying and selling, you know, you're going to find yourself in a society where those who own things will have power over those who do not. So I think one way to think about the character question, to make it, you know, seem like we're not going too quick, is it seems as if, you know, you need some explanation for why people develop the type of character that they do. So one way is to say that people are just intrinsically pathological, intrinsically evil. It's a mark of their evolution. It's a mark of theological, you know, sin, etc. Or you say that character is often a response to a type of environment, structure, series of habits. And so when Stanley, I think what he's trying to say is, you know, actually, look at the type of character one would have to form in order to make their way in a society that's increasingly becoming premised on buying and selling, on arbitrary power, etc. And so I think partially it's up to West to decide what is more plausible. But I like this idea that he wants to think that our institutions actually have, if not like an absolute determinative power over our character, certainly shape the conditions for how we develop something like shared characteristics, shared habits and shared expectations. So I think it's really nice to say that we can still keep the character talk, but then, you know, be like explicit about, you know, what conditions character, and making it clear that you can either go with this kind of like metaphysical, people are just evil and bad, or you can look at, well, what character would you form when you find yourself, you know, cut off from the land, when you have to take up these new types of relations of subservience, etc. So my opening salvo is, I like the idea of linking character to social pathologies. It seems to me that's a nice explanatory vein to explore.
Yeah, if I could pull a quote to go to this from relatively early on in The Law of Freedom and a Platform. He says, I'm talking about this relationship between oppressor and oppressed, which has everything to do with these property questions, these relationships of property and hierarchy. And then he says, as for inward bondages, I meddle not in this place. Right, I'm not going to talk about that stuff, but he goes, though I am assured that, if it be rightly searched into, the inward bondages of the mind, as covetousness, pride, hypocrisy, envy, sorrow, fears, desperation, and madness, all are occasioned by the outward bondage that one sort of people lay upon another, right? This is like a very materialist sort of approach to thinking about what it is that we find in people's characters, where these things come from. He's like, you know, I would be worried about that envy stuff if I didn't think that it's actually the property relation first that's the issue. It's almost as though he mm-hmm. thinks that these questions of virtue, of character, are downstream, right, from these material social relations, and that if we were to like adequately address these relationships of like dominance and subservience, of ownership and bondage, a lot of these mental pathologies kind of get resolved. I think that this is his gamble, I suppose.
I don't feel like we've improved. Have we improved?
Wait, in what way?
What do you mean?
Like in political theory. Like, okay. I say this shit all the time. And I feel like I haven't convinced like enough people.
We haven't, yeah.
And I feel like the theoretical like status quo militates against me, but I just like these guys knew what was up. What am I doing? I should just like put this pamphlet all over, you know, Sarfati Park in Amsterdam and see if people pick up on it.
I do love the like obviousness with which he says a lot of this stuff. He's like, well, you know, it's patently obvious that like buying and selling is like the root of, you know, all of our social pathologies. I mean, like, you can't make our survival predicated on like whether you own stuff or not. I mean, that's crazy,
that's
obviously.
Ridiculous. Like, that's, yeah.
If your life is hinged to this type of relationship and there can be no development of your character without your life, well, yeah, guess what? You are going to start to form yourself to the demands that this relation places upon you, and definitely to the arbitrary whims that those who have the means of life, you know, place on you. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, that just does seem obvious. And what I also love about it is he's trying to say, and you know, again, I'm not like well-versed in this history, but things like the enclosures, there were prior sort of customary relations, cultural habits of how to deal with the commons. And yeah, once you start imposing this buying and selling relation, you tear that shit up. Maybe you try to transform it a little bit, but I think when Stanley's not fooled, he's like, no, this is a very different form of life. Don't try to sell it to us like, you know, everything remains the same. And so you knock out even like, you know, the foundation of the prior relations for character. And so, yeah, why wouldn't people become something different? I think, yeah, we should go to these poli-sci departments who are crossing picket lines and drop a little Win Stanley off there. You know, I want to get too ahead of my skis, but
What's also just amazing to me on Lillian's point, though, is that it's simultaneously hilarious and a little bit enraging to see such familiar debates. If you read some of the other literature of this period, especially the Levellers, playing out, I mean, you've got basically, you know, a moment that is fraught with possibility and, you know, with potential for major social transformation. And you've got on one side Levellers, and not all of them, some of them were fairly radical, but a lot of what the Levellers were doing was like liberal juridical stuff. Mm. I mean, they wanted to establish a constitution. They made this original constitution for England called an Agreement of the People, which laid out broadly liberal rights-based order. And then you've got people like Win Stanley saying like, oh no, it's actually, if you really want all of those things that the Levellers say they want, if you really want a level society, well, like you actually have to, you need socialism or you need communism, you need something that gets at the economic dimension of these various oppressions that we're facing. And it's like, that's just an extremely common argument. I mean, it played itself out in 1848 in Europe too, like whether you had this like contingent of what you could call like liberal radicals and then a contingent of socialists who are saying, no, we can't get any of those good things actually unless we go all the way economically and extend these principles into the economic sphere. And so, yeah, there's just a little bit of like a painful familiarity of the arguments going down in the 1640s and 50s.
But the plausibility of it is so direct, right? Because his basic point is like, yeah, well, this is like, what are the conditions for life, for the possibility of life and existence? Yeah. And it's like, all right, what's necessary for social reproduction? And it's like, okay, well, I'm going to need the fruits of my labor and the fruits of the earth. And that just means like, if someone else owns the land and it's their property, then I got nothing. I'm fucked, right? Then
yeah.
And it's just like, well, yeah, that's it. It's kind of that straightforward.
It's again that he's not responding to some whole field of like hypothetical objectors too. He's like, well, you know, what will we do instead? We'll have common storehouses where people will get their stuff. And he's like, well, and she said, well, what if someone says people will just steal things from those storehouses? What are you talking about? We'll have laws against that. Like, we'll have common storehouses. It's like people will.
He's just like what? You dummy? Like, why? This would be like a more rational society. Yeah. Of course we'd have laws about that. What? Come on. But okay, so, but here's the thing that I think when Stanley's getting, I think that this starts to bleed into the kingly power stuff, which I absolutely love, which is, you know, so yes, particular types of economic arrangements, especially when they mediate the conditions of, you know, biological life, cultural life, social life, etc., clearly shape the types of activities we're going to engage in our outlooks. But I also think he's making another type of point. He's making the point that also the way these economic arrangements are arranged also often justify that society should be arranged this way, that this is how power should be interwoven into our lives. And so it seems to me that also the problem is, you know, I know I could get into trouble using this word sort of, you know, like, you know, the problem of the ideological appreciation of society is that it's not just I am literally barred from the means of life because I have to engage in this buying and selling relation, but it also is a way of implicitly making the case that this is the way society ought to be ordered. And if you don't get at those also those justifications, then your reforms might simply assume, okay, well, we need a better society that still has the buying and selling relation as central. So, you know, basically what I'm trying to say is there is like, you know, the physical force of barring people from the means of life, but there's also the attempt to try to justify to these people, yes, this is the way society should be ordered, or that this is the way that society, the only way society will be ordered. And I think he's also trying to get us to get to a radical revision of the justifications we use to organize society. That if you also don't pull that up, then you do already kind of limit the range of options of what the good society might look like.
So this is, that's helpful because it helps me like articulate, you know, he's got his like lists of enemies and the people that he hates, and it's like kings and tyrants, but also clergy, the tithers, landlords he hates, and lawyers, as we've mentioned, there. Right? And the clergy and the lawyers both have like a similar sort of like ideological shaping role, especially in this time, right? When in the early 1600s in England in particular, but, you know, lots of places in Europe, there's like, you know, economic devastation, there's famine, there's mass starvation. And then like the land is, as he puts it, like he's not saying like we're going to take the best land. He's like, we're going to dig up some of these wastes and plant carrots and beans. And like that's the shit that people are passing laws about and like, you know, executing peasants for just like planting beans on wasteland, right? And asserting that, like, no, that wasteland has to remain uncultivated and not held in common. That's, in fact, a matter of private property. And this is, like, there's an order to this societal arrangement of property that, like, has some, I don't know, if not a natural basis. I mean, this is one of the interesting things about Win Stanley and, like, we did Thomas More a while back thinking about enclosures. They saw this new property regime as not something that could be defended as natural, right? Like, because it was being so, like, arbitrarily and forcefully imposed.
Mm-hmm.
How many people do I know who just, like, we all rent. None of us own any property. That's just the way it is. Everyone's got a landlord. This was, like, a moment in time when, like, that was, like, a new thing.
Yeah.
That they were like, hey, that's fucking crazy.
What do you mean you're the lord of this land? You know, glad that this is a passing phase. Never going to hear about those things again. Cut to 2023.
Well, imagine for like hundreds of years, like you and all of your your predecessors are all just cultivating land and using it to graze, like to let your livestock graze and all that. And then all of a sudden, at one point, someone just comes up and says, "Yeah, you actually have to pay me for that now. Like you have to pay me. This is this thing called mine, right?"
Oh, okay.
Oh, shit.
And here's money? Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I wonder if part of like when Stanley's question, when he's talking about kingly power, and I wonder if this, we can think about this almost contemporarily. We often talk about, you know, the working class needs power or socialists need power, et cetera. And I think one of the debates that constantly happen, especially, say, with the state, is do we mean that we want to take over the existing power so that, you know, we should be the ones in the positions mm-hmm. and all of that? Or do we want society governed by a wholly different type of power? You know, I was recently reading Lucian Lucio Coletti on Lenin's State and Revolution. And he's saying, you know, actually part of what Lenin is saying is that society needs to be replaced by a different type of governing power. And that's part of what he's doing with the state. And so I thought maybe that's what he's getting at. He's trying to say, you know, yes, we want reforms, but it is not enough if those reforms are still cashed out through kingly power. It seems he wants to say we need an alternate form of power, an alternate justification of power that he's like looking at the Bible to justify.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, but here's where we run into like a sort of classical aporia of like revolutionary politics and praxis, right? Because I think he's on that side, right? Where he thinks that, no, right, we're not going to just do new kingly power with us in charge, right? He's trying to oppose kingly power top to bottom. And he's got this cool set of oppositions, right? There's like kingly power versus the power of righteousness, right, on the side of the oppressed and the impoverished. Not the law of the sword, which is that which is establishing this private property regime, but the law of freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And that's cool. I love all that. And the fact that he's able to like do this really cool radical detournement of like Christian thought and citing scripture in favor of this is sick. But like the parts where like the Christianity I could tell is going to be a problem is like ours is not to spill blood, but to suffer. And it's like, well, you know, maybe you should spill a little blood. I don't know.
And there's a couple moments like that where you're like, damn, the Puritanism, it's coming, it's shining through. And you're like, fuck, man, you're so close.
You're so close.
Because you know? It's the same thing when he talks about idleness and, you know.
Was he a Puritan?
Well, I think he was deeply influenced by, I think, the puritanical transformations that were going on. And certainly when he says things like, there's not going to be idleness, I promise, under this like new regime. Mm. Anybody that doesn't want to work, like, we're just going to make them work. Like, they have, you know what I mean?
I pretended I didn't see him say that.
Like in Rhode
Actually,
Island.
I had a different reading of that line, actually.
Okay. Yeah, let me hear it.
Because
I got bummed the fuck out when I read that.
I think it's actually just the other way around. He's not like these fucking idle peasants need to be disciplined. I think he's talking about the kings and landlords who don't fucking work.
That did occur to me maybe too, yeah.
These are the people, as he says, who clothe themselves in the labor of others, right? They're the idle motherfuckers who need to be put to put out into the field, I think.
I think that's right, actually, Gil.
Okay, well, yeah, because thank you, Gil. Yeah.
Because he's responding to critics, right? Again, such familiar criticisms. Like, he says, okay, what if someone suggests that everyone will just be lazy under this great new regime where the world is like all a commons? And he says lazy, like idleness, like that's the issue we have now. It's like it's people that are totally idle that get all the stuff. Yeah. You know what I mean? They get all the money they live in plenty, and it's the people that do so. If anything, like, you know, cool. It's conceivable that a future society will have less idleness. And yeah, but I do think there's some moments where there's an ethos of Puritanism, if I can put it that way, definitely. Lillian. Like, there's a puritanical ethos a little bit that, like, suffuses some of the work.
I do think there's, like, a cool inversion that he's doing, too, with regard to the received, like, one way in which he's definitely not, like, this sort of classical Puritan, I think. We have this way of thinking about labor and laboring on the earth as this sort of punishment. In the sort of classical theological way of thinking. And like, he talks about labor in a completely different way. He talks about as this, like, this loving communal spiritual thing that, like, we're not condemned to labor. Like, labor is our way of producing for ourselves and others. And this is like the form of freedom, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. And it's hard to imagine, because what he's talking about is labor, not under conditions of like enclosure and private ownership of the fruits of those labor,
right?
But as labor under communal and free conditions.
Yeah. This sounds pretty cool, except I always wonder about these kinds of like kind of proto egalitarian movements. Because I think that I actually kind of mean it, that like I'm not sure we're more sophisticated now. But I do think that like part of the innovation of modern socialism is to say that the material conditions for an egalitarian way of life are met under capitalism for the first time, the productive forces. Right. And like, I can't even imagine a kind of egalitarian, like, proto-socialism and, like, the shit conditions those people were living in. Like, that sounds like hell on earth, to be totally honest with you. I mean, not hell on earth relative to their expectations, but relative to ours. Like, I'm sure it would have been a big step up for the poors in the 17th century. But there's a way in which I'm kind of like, I'm almost glad this didn't, like, happen at that time. Because, like, if we're being real,
our lives are probably so
we
bad.
Needed a little more of the productive forces.
Well, I think, like, again, Locke's argument was, like, responding. And, you know, people have said that it is a kind of implicit response to the levelers. Was that, like, remember in the property chapter, he says, the earth is given to us as a commons. Mm-hmm. Right? The problem is that, like, it's fucking useless as a commons. Like, the way you activate its, like, maximum productive potential is if you let people carve it up and do what, you know, Winstanley's fencing in and fencing out, let people have their own, like, little plot, and then imagine what they'll do with it once they get motivated by that covetousness and that, you know, the desire to accumulate wealth. And so, like, there is an argument that, I mean, that is Locke's argument that, like, all that commons is great. It's kind of worthless unless we let it be privately developed. I mean, life's going to be shit still.
The social harmony that emerges is amazing.
The marker replaced war. We all sure see did. And yeah. approach each other as equals.
Ward, I guess I did talk myself into colonialism. That's true. Sorry. Sorry about that, guys.
No, but I mean, I think it actually, it is a fair point that, like, life just, they're not working with a lot here in terms of making in 1640s in terms of making a good, you know, egalitarian social world. I mean, it's not.
There is not universal health care. That is true. So I think it's so interesting, you know, when we read these things, like, you know, we find these really fertile ideas, but we live in 2023. And so I don't think anyone listening should hear us as saying, like, we need to go back to the 16th century, you know, wipe the slate clean, let's do it again. But what I think it actually makes us wrestle with, though, is and you started going down this path, you and Lillian, is that, you know, the thing is, conservatives or centrists or liberals, you know, however they're arrayed, they do have a, you know, at least on its face, a plausible argument for why enclosures and stuff like that, and even things we call social pathologies, like covetousness, like greed, maybe even fear of, you know, going hungry, actually ends up producing, you know, the world that we have now. And so I could see someone like, you know, responding to this and saying something like, okay, you might not like kings, but, you know, once you got a boss on your back, I bet you're going to start squeezing more out of the world. It's, I think partially, you know, Winstanley's argument, he obviously doesn't give us like a fully fleshed out economic program of how society ought to function. But I think he is asking, you know, I hesitate to use the word primordial, but a more basic question about, you know, well, what type of society ought we have and how should we justify it? And, you know, I tend to think that if you think the way to justify society is, you know, we have to treat people almost like, you know, they are cattle who need to be poked and prod and threatened in order to get them to do things. And you're increasingly, you're talking less about freedom and more about, well, these people need masters. And if that actually is your position, and some conservatives on the right, that is their position. They'll say hierarchies.
I think it's liberals' position too. I mean, like, let's be clear.
I was trying to, I was trying to let them off.
No, I mean, like anywhere from like a kind of like kind of liberal progressive orientation, like the idea that people just like don't know, like if they're too free, then they don't know what to do with their freedom. Like, I think that's a pretty common ideological position to have. And it comes like from pretty surprising places, like a soft, like I was just listening to Killer Mike talk the other day on a podcast where like, it's kind of a progressive black nationalist position. And his whole thing was like, we've only been free for 60 years. Of course, we don't know what to do with our freedom. We need to like put our cash into like a central fund, you know, and like kind of prod people into good character. Like, I just think that like basically that people need the kind of need a little strong arm for their own good. But I think like a left position is you're thinking more about institutional, you're thinking more about infrastructure than the fact that people don't know what's good for them. But I do think the line is pretty fine. And like that position comes from like a pretty wide range of views and not just the right. We don't really tend to actually think people have their shit together. And we tend to have pretty low opinions of them. I think middle class people generally have really low opinions of poor people, like as a whole. Maybe that's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. that's the view of like the founding text of like modern political thought, right? That's the view of Leviathan, is that like we just cannot like be left to our own devices. And in fact, it's an anti-freedom tract, right? So too much freedom. Freedom is actually really bad. What we want to do is like what you want. Trust me, believe me. What you want is to have your freedom curtailed. Yeah. Right? Is have your freedom curtailed and everybody else's freedom curtailed. And what you get is peace. And he's just trying to make a total, he's trying to make, again, a completely contrary point, which is that, like, you know, there's nothing about our nature that is inimical to peace or that makes peace impossible. What's the problem is precisely, it's the institutions, it's the social structure, it's the economic system that produces the quarreling. He says it produces, we just get really quarrelsome, both at the level of like big, you know, war, social and political level, but also at the individual level. It makes us fight. It makes us covetous. It makes us envious of one another. It makes us suspicious of one another. And I mean, really, yeah. I don't know if these can be proved. I don't know which can be proved anthropologically. And there is a part of me that almost thinks like you have to take, it's a fucking gambit basically of socialism. Like that at least a certain amount of these things we tend to associate with the miserableness of human nature are actually a result of like history and economics. And that it's not, otherwise the idea is just that, you know, it's impossible to do anything better.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I actually think the contrast between Hobbes and Winstanley is actually like really representative of a debate that there's not a great answer for, that you kind of have to just admit that both sides have a hunch and they're making their best guess. So like what I said about like most people share this intuition, as far as I understand, that basically people don't know what to do with their own freedom and they need to be kind of prodded in the right direction. You know, I heard a student once ask a Marxist philosopher, who I will leave unnamed, like, why are you so sure? Like, basically, like, you're Winstanley and I'm Hobbes, you know, just like imagine that play out in a lecture hall. Okay. And I remember the response was actually one of the more honest things I've ever heard. He was just like, you know, what I want you to understand is like, that's your best guess. Like, and you have a set of reasons for that. But at the end of the day, you've got a hunch that this is what people are really like. And I've got an alternative guess about what people are really like. And I think that sounds really true to me.
Yeah.
Because, like, I actually agree. Like, one of the reasons I'm never going to develop a kind of, like, radically pessimist or, like, well, you know, what passes as, like, self-interested realism or whatever view of politics is, like, when I see human beings in, like, nicely put together public spaces, I, like, see them enjoying themselves and coexisting. And I'm like, wow, I think they actually want to do that. I think that sounds great. And they would do it more if they had the opportunity. And but someone else looks at that and they're like, wow, what a dirty shithole or whatever. So like at some level, it actually is kind of your guess at like what's going on underneath it all.
One thing I think I can say here is that if that's right, right, and all we have are these like two sort of hunches about what the fundamental fucking philosophical anthropology is at base. Well, we've tried for 500 years now one way of organizing society. which is the property regime, in which is like, you know, when Stanley talks about like whether you think that people are naturally going to be envious and covetous or not. Well, a world in which like a handful of people own everything and everyone else has nothing and they have to scramble in order to survive can only produce a certain kind of disorder, right? Like, I almost want to say like, fine, have your hunch, but wouldn't an alternative mode of organizing social relations and production and distribution that actually meets people's basic needs be good on that alternative hypothesis, right? Even if you're like the nasty, brutish and short guy, why wouldn't you still prefer us to like have things in common and have people like be fed instead of, as he says, like, you know, he's always talking about like the arbitrariness of like how things are doled out in respect of persons. And I think he's always just chafing at the fact that he's like, who the fuck made you king? Literally, right? Like, why do you get to own the stuff and why does everyone else have to be poor and begging? Like, that's just arbitrary. And I think that even if you're, like I said, even if you've got the pessimistic anthropology, there's something not defensible about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one way we can come at this is, you know, we can have our hunches. And I actually do kind of find it interesting that we start ending up talking about something in the neighborhood of, so what do, what types of social relations do we think people can hold? And those of us who are on the left or who are Marxists who think that a radically different regime of economic and social relations is not only possible, but, you know, something that is normatively endorsable, we are also saying something like that people can become a radically different type of, I think this is linked from the Communist Manifesto, a radically different type of human material. Mm-hmm. That they can not only learn to do this, but, you know, it would actually be to the benefit of something like freedom. And, you know, what I find interesting here is that what we are ending up talking about is something like, to have a type of society, if we're having these hunches, we have to be able to justify it. And, you know, and so if your only justification of it is something like, you know, I just believe people are naturally evil or greedy or something like that, or simply, well, those are the people in power and they get the right to do it, at least we can also make the argument, I think this is what Gil was saying, is that that isn't actually a strong argument for why we need to continue this 500, 600 year long journey mm-hmm. of these private property relations. In order to say something like there's something unjustifiable in these relations, we don't need the whole picture worked out on what, you know, human beings and culture would look like. You know, we can, you know, simply point to these justifications are based on a type of hunch on human character. And, you know, the only reason we seem to be keeping with that is out of inertia or because there are forces of repression. I was reading Kathy Weeks' The Problem with Work, and she was describing how liberals approach utopianism, and she was describing it as this almost damned if you do, damned if you don't movement of, you have to be anti-utopian every time liberalism seems to be in danger, but also you have to be anti-utopian when liberalism seems to be assured and is the only option. And, you know, this seems like a way of just simply cutting off the conversation, well, how should power be arranged in our society, by invoking these hazy sorts of ideas of, you know, people are naturally, well, the way that the society seems to make them be. And so I like that when Stanley is offering, well, a glimpse into a different picture of how we could justify power arrangements, and that doesn't need to simply say he knows how we're going to be. He can make the argument by saying how we arrange society now is incredibly brutal, deprives people of resources. There isn't really a justification for why we should do it that way rather than another way.
Yeah, these arguments are weak. I don't know. It just.
Yeah,
I agree. I agree with you. I just think these are fucking bad arguments for like why we've got to continue this misery.
I also just have to say that I spontaneously accept his view, which, granted, for him, it's like pretty scripturally based that like we're not beasts, like we're not animals, and so like we actually are, we're capable of doing more than engaging in just like fierce battle with one another. Because very much like,
have we returned? I'm excited. We've returned to this thing. Please defend your view. It's been a while.
Hobbes very famously says that, you know, man is a beast to man and man is a god to man. And like when Stanley, so yeah, Hobbes is not saying, yeah, we're not just animals, because we can also, like, we can artificially create structures of dominion that allow us to live in peace. Right? Mm-hmm. But when Stanley is saying, like, you know, that's not the full picture. I mean, man is a beast to man. Yes, man can be a god to man, but we can also be equals with one another. And that's like a third, again, philosophical, anthropological claim. And it's not like there's no evidence for that. It's not like there's no evidence of solidarity in human history. There's plenty of evidence of it. And so, like, again, I don't think it's something that can be proven. I do think part of it is just a gambit and in some of the ways that you guys have been describing it. But mm-hmm. it's a pretty plausible position.
And it seems like, why not fight for a world where solidarity is the principle that underwrites freedom, rather than fight for a world where, well, there just has to be a little bit of arbitrary dominion as a treat, you know? That's the only way we can do this. And I really do, you know, I'm really getting into this stuff about, you know, freedom being a type of, you know, free time. And I at least think it is clarifying, you know, with these types of Winstanleyan arguments, of getting people to admit that what they really mean mean is that people shouldn't really have control over their time, that they can't be trusted with it, that, you know, mm-hmm. they need to be dominated in order for there to be some type of social order. But I imagine when Winstanley's making this argument, whatever progress has been made under kingly power, you know, whether it's, you know, techniques or types of institutions, they don't necessarily need to be thrown away. What I find puzzling about these arguments against social transformation is I'm wondering what our institutions would look like if they were arrayed under a different type of social power. So what would, you know, for instance, the productive technologies of capitalism look like if instead of the dominion of capital, it was the dominion of social intercourse, of equality? You know, what human would that needs. Look like? Or human needs. But it seems like that question gets blocked off and it's assumed that, oh, you don't get any of the good stuff without this bad stuff. And I'm thinking historical transformations almost never work like that. It's not ever that there is a transformation in history and everything's wiped clean and you got to start over again. So the question is, well, why this form of society rather than another if we're assuming that there is no time travel? We're not going to go back to the 15th century. So what would it look like? What types of people would we be? And I don't know, but it's not a good enough argument to say, well, you know, capitalism gave us iPads and so now you want us to, what, you know, make fire with rocks again.
Yeah, and he's like, you know, you guys are almost there. You accept, like, you don't want arbitrary dominion in the public sphere. Okay, well, we also don't want arbitrary dominion in the private sphere. I mean, it's not like, again, it's funny the way that, like, he just has this simplicity that I really love. He's like, yeah, you're super, super close. You get it. Like, we should live in a commonwealth or in a republic and in a non-kingly government. We just got a little bit further to go.
The real question, though, is will there still be lawyers in this new form of life? And it seems that when Stanley's like, they don't make it.
I almost want to ask, like, what the hell were lawyers up to in the 1600s that makes them stand out so prominently as just enemies of humanity to Winstanley? They're just like the primary enemies of humanity.
He even says something like, this world will never be good as long as lawyers, you know, have set foot on the earth. They are the bane of life and Christ will not let them
stay. I
imagine
they're like adjudicating new property claims and shit like that, right? Like they're adjudicating where the lines are drawn, who has access to what. And yeah, and Winstanley's whole energy is just like, this, who the fuck are you? I mean, this is...
One thing I think is interesting is like how in the kind of the specific way in which he's like a religious thinker is like very imminent. He's not otherworldly or afterworldly at all. No. He says at some point that, like, you know, part of the problem with the lawyers and the kings are the people who are like promising that life is going to be hell for you now. And the clergy are telling you that, like, you're going to have hell in the afterlife. And he's looking around and being like, actually, this is already hell. He's like, what are you talking about? And like, and similarly, like, he's not talking about like salvation in an afterlife. He's like, no, like, paradise is here. Like, this is, it's on this earth that something better can be made as well. There's no afterworldly orientation.
No need to wait.
Yeah, no need to wait.
And likewise, like, in the other direction, like, our original fall, like, as he calls it, is super interesting because it isn't really something divine. It's like kind of a proto primitive accumulation account of like the Norman conquest. Mm-hmm. It's like things were going great. Anglo-Saxons were living communally. We were just doing our thing. And then fucking William the Conqueror Normans. Came over. Yeah. And the bloody Normans.
Fucking Normans.
Exactly. They came over. And so like, and they started just like imposing kings and dividing up land and making dukes and lords and all these different, making lords and all this stuff. And so like, I just find it really fascinating that he, again, it reminds me a little bit, again, obviously it's quite different. He's not a proto-Marxist per se, but although some have argued that, but there is like a view that things also didn't get this way naturally. There's a story of conquest that lies behind all titles, right?
Yes.
Behind all titles and all legitimate claims to like ownership. And there is a history of conquest.
It is,
I mean,
the
that's
sword.
Also just true.
It's the sword.
That's also actually just true. I mean, the sword is like, is how all of these nations got parceled up into mine and thine.
So there's a way in which looking at what Win Stanley is doing is he's also offering a counter narrative. He is saying that the dominant narrative is that there's something divine about kings and lords and all that. And I think there is something really powerful about him being like, no, let me give you a different narrative of how all of this happened. From that different narrative, you also get a different view of what human character or human nature could be. We are kind of like narrative creatures. And so I think it's really powerful that Win Stanley is saying, one, I actually kind of like the move of it's not hell in the afterlife. You know, it seems like you're promising us hell now and like maybe heaven. Yeah. And two, saying that, you know, this thing that, you know, is fetishized as natural, as obvious, as permanent is actually relatively recent and was brought here by blood and swords. And I think you have to take a different comportment to society if you buy that narrative. And that's important part of the pamphlets. It's meant to, you know, affect social consciousness, get people to see a different narrative of how their world came to be. And if they do, if they really adhere to the reasons of that narrative, it does commit them at least to a different set of expectations, even if they don't have the power to control society and continue to do what they're doing.
Man, the pamphlets rule, though. Like, I have like a, maybe it's like overly, like, I'm overly fantasizing about it, but it's not historically accurate. But I just have this like vibe of like this period in England, and people are just handing you like little tracts of political philosophy everywhere you go. Like, you go to the bar and like some group's trying to recruit you, and like, so like, I don't know.
Now we have Twitter, and it's like most annoying thing in the world. Yeah. Again, like Lillian said, I'm not sure we've progressed.
No, not clear.
It's a pretty like metal period in political philosophy. Yeah. I feel like that's my takeaway from today's discussion.
Agreed.
Yeah.
It's there's only like a couple moments I feel like that in like this in the history of the West where they are so fraught and super open and there's so much that's possible. And, you know, and like Christopher Hill says that it's this kind of stuff was the revolt in the English Revolution.
Yeah.
And it ended up losing, like the German Revolution lost, you know what I mean? Or like, you know, whatever, Spain went the wrong way at a moment where it might have gone very differently, or, you know, and it's just one of those moments. And it happens to be accompanied by a absolute explosion of political thought. I think it's like a lot of it's really sophisticated.
Like, yeah.
I mean, it seems like it was a moment where it seemed like society was up for grabs and, you know,
100%.
There are real stakes to this. And what followed from that is just an amazing set of ideas that's really cool to revisit.
One of the reasons why it was so up for grabs was super interesting is that, like, Parliament, in order for its cause to be victorious, even a lot of people that were from the gentry and from the landowning property classes, like, they wanted to mobilize what they called, like, the multitudes, like, the urban multitudes to their side, to use them basically as a kind of political pawn. But in doing so, they ended up, like, politicizing huge, like, they ended up politicizing the masses. And so, like, they then couldn't pull it back fully under control. Cromwell was specifically in this position of, like, now he was like the levelers and Cromwell were like, you know, they were sympathetic with each other and what for a moment. And then he's got to like try to put everything kind of back in the bottle once the radicalism starts to bubble up a little bit too much. So yeah, just like, I don't know, a fascinating set of dynamics. It's, I think, the reason why Hobbes is like obsessed with the multitude, like in his political philosophy, that he is super worried about them conceiving of themselves as some kind of political entity. It's very important that they just be understand themselves as individuals. Right. And stay like a dissolved multitude or whatever. So I don't know. Yeah. It's
Because the minute people start getting together in groups, they start like, you know, planting carrots and tearing down fences. It's not
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Enough of that shit.
I mean, this was behind like some of what I was trying to do like in my dissertation and in what I'm working on a little bit right now is like that Hobbes is very much like reacting to this moment of just like radical group formation everywhere he looks around. You know, it just seems to be that people are finding each other and they're organizing around political ideas. Some of them are arming themselves. And this for him is just radically incompatible with what he thinks is like an ordered state.
With peace.
Yeah, with peace. Yeah.
Security.
Yeah. Anyways, okay. So I think that does it for us today. New episodes of What's Left of Philosophy come out every 2 weeks, wherever you get your podcasts. Also, check us out on YouTube for videos and live streams. Before closing out today, we'd like to take a minute to thank some of the people who are supporting the show on Patreon. We couldn't do this without you, and we're really grateful. Today's new patrons are Sylvia, Julia Negrao, Nick Kay, Mitchell Harris, Drew Jones, Matthew Templeton, Finley Reed, Tapchi Garba, Devin Booth, Artemis, Zach Infantino, Joshua Silikas, Emma J, Aleph, Jimbo Patreon, Uncultivated Identity, Jesse Friedman, Michael Spencer, Jack Skinner, and Sean Beaulieu. Thank you all very much. If you too like what we're doing and want to support the show, please go to our website, leftofphilosophy.com, and click the support button. Patrons get access to exclusive content like locked episodes, bonus videos, and access to our Discord server. You can also buy some What's Left of Philosophy merch from the store on our website. Follow us on Twitter at @leftofphil, and don't forget to leave us good reviews and comments on your podcast app. With that, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Take care. Oh, yeah. Come to Toronto. Check us out.
Come to Toronto.
Free Times Cafe, October 12th.